seem counterintuitive, but surgeons have a rich history of palliating both their patients and their families. I am Red Hoffman, an acute care surgeon in Asheville, North Carolina, and one of 79 surgeons currently board certified in hospice and palliative medicine. Join me as I interview the founders and the leaders of the surgical palliative care movement, a diverse group of surgeons dedicated to providing high-quality palliative medicine to all surgical and trauma patients. Welcome to the Surgical Palliative Care Podcast. We heal with more than steel. Hi, everyone. This is Red Hoffman. Thank you for joining me for another episode of the Surgical Palliative Care Podcast. Today's episode is a collaboration with the folks at the Jerry Pell Podcast. I just want to thank Eric, Alex, and Joe for inviting me to the show and for serenading me with an excellent cover of one of my very favorite songs. We talked about surgical palliative care and discussed a recent retrospective study of the use of palliative care in VA patients undergoing high-risk surgery. I hope you enjoy listening as much as I enjoyed recording.
The Jerry Pell Podcast is brought to you by Archstone Foundation, preparing society and meeting the needs of an aging population. And now, here are your hosts.
Welcome to the Jerry Pell. Wait, this is not just the Jerry Pell Podcast. This is a combined
Jerry Pell and the Surgical Palliative Care Podcast.
With Red Hoffman.
Red Hoffman is a acute care surgeon in North Carolina and host of the Surgical Palliative Care Podcast. Welcome to your own podcast and our podcast, Red.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Thank you for having us on your podcast. Look at that.
How about you? That?
This is a Jerry Pell first.
We awesome. Also have Joe Lynn in studio here, and Joe is a UCSF resident in surgery who is also right now completing his palliative care fellowship. And you've been on the Jerry Pell Podcast before, right, Joe?
I have.
And welcome back as a guest and guest host.
So we're going to be talking about surgical palliative care, but before we do, we always have a song request. Red, do you have a song request for Alex?
I do, Alex. I would love if you could play me Africa by Toto.
And why?
Well, this is one of the two songs that my dead father comes to visit me with on the radio. So I thought it was appropriate given today's topic.
Yeah.
And that is meant to be a happy thought, not a morbid thought.
Yeah.
Wait, is it, do you want the Toto version or the Weezer version?
They're kind of the same.
The Weezer version is great too, but yes, they sound very similar to me.
They do. I was like, why did they cover it if they're just going to like karaoke the same song?
Because it's so great to sing. That's why.
You know the funny thing about Africa? So my car kind of loads my songs up for me. And every time I start my car and my phone gets on the Bluetooth, it plays Africa. Like every single time.
Because
it's A. And we are so sick.
So you know this song.
That.
So Eric and Joe will be joining in on this song. Join in on the chorus.
I stopped an old man along the way, hoping to find some old forgotten words or ancient melodies. He turned to me as if to say, hurry, boy, it's waiting there for you.
Here we go.
It's gonna take a lot to take me away from you. There's nothing 100 men or more could ever do. I bless the rains down in Africa. Gonna take some time to do the things we never had.
You guys rock. Thank you.
Despite actually hearing that song on a multi-day basis, I actually still have no idea what the words are. I thought it was I catched some rays in down in Africa, but it's I blessed some rains.
The rains down in Africa.
The raids.
Oh, yeah. I thought they were catching waves down in Africa. Whatever, it sounded great to me. Thank you. Great.
Joe, what do you think they were saying?
I was reading the lyrics.
Oh, yeah.
Well, our topic of today is surgery and palliative care. And we often like to start this podcast by talking with both of you about what got you interested in this area. As you note in the introduction to your podcast, Red, there are, 79 surgeons trained in surgery and palliative care. I wonder if it's starting with you, Red, if you could tell us a little bit about your journey and why you became interested in this, these two, to some people, seemingly disparate topics.
Sure. So, unfortunately, my dad was actually killed 26 years ago now, and it really changed the trajectory of my life. In the end, it made me extremely interested in trauma, which is what I ended up pursuing, but also really interested in grief and kind of the isolation that can come when something tragic and unexpected happens. And I was very lucky. I went to medical school at OHSU in Portland, Oregon. You know, Oregon's the birthplace of the death with dignity. It's where the POLST form was born. And so palliative care was just well integrated into my medical school training. And so I ended up developing this kind of these dual interests that eventually I was able to pursue.
How about you, Joe?
I started to get interested in medical school. There was a sort of a well-integrated sort of geriatrics and palliative care sort of course in our undergrad education. And then clinically sort of fell in love with surgery. And then coming to residency here, you know, I was having such a fantastic training and really loved everything I was doing, but just felt like there was this piece missing of having, you know, both the time and the training to sort of address that aspect of our patients' care. And so the pieces just kind of fell into place for me to do this fellowship, and it's been great.
I love this. You know, normally we interview internists, researchers, and they like give us like 10-minute answers and we have to interrupt them and cut them down. Surgeons,
get to the point.
Concise stories. Very concise.
Got to keep moving forward.
Right. So what is it, I'm interested to hear from both of you what it's like to train in palliative care. Now, Joe, you're doing this now in the midst of your surgical residency. And what do your co-residents think about this? And then we'll turn to Red after hearing from you, Joe.
I think a lot of my co-residents are like super supportive and think that makes a lot of sense. And I think in some ways wish a little bit that they could have time to do this sort of thing too. It's definitely very different though. You know, I think whereas like all my co-residents are kind of going to lab or you know, doing clinical research type stuff. I'm like still going to work and holding the pager, but you know, but it's the work itself is actually like is you know, incredible and really rewarding though. So
was there a shift at all going from like the surgical pace to more of the palliative care pace of things, or was it just natural, like felt the same?
Definitely a shift. I think like in the pace and timing and stuff. I mean, certainly not starting the day at like 5:30, just,
bonus.
You know, 6:15. a lot of it, I think, is the same. You know, in surgery, we're working with really super sick patients all the time with really complex symptom management and psychosocial needs. And so a lot of that was very similar. And I think that the difference was just kind of having the time to address a lot of those things. And then also like the multidisciplinary team to support me as both a learner and a provider for those patients.
And Red, how about you? As I understood your training, you did surgery first, then palliative care?
That's correct. I did surgery, then surgical critical care, and then a fellowship in palliative care.
And then palliative care. And how was it to train in palliative care after coming out of all of that surgical training?
Well, in some ways, some of the feedback was even more painful. You know, it's very common in surgery to hear that you suck, basically, constantly. But it's you don't take that so personally. But in palliative care, some of the feedback I got was very personal. Like, for instance, I tend to have a resting smile face. Like, I just have a natural smile on my face. And the feedback I got was that that smile seems inappropriate during these family meetings. I was like, that's my face. You know? So I'm not sure what to do with that feedback. And the pace was certainly slower. And sometimes actually my attendings, who were lovely and great and very supportive of my being a surgeon and wanting to go back to being a surgeon, you know, they would just say, like, we're just sensing the surgeon in you today. Like, slow it down, settle in. You don't have to be in a rush. You have here, you really have the time to just sit and be. So I learned a lot. I came in thinking I was so great at communication, and I was humbled by how much I had to learn. And then one more thing, as Joe said, that support of that interdisciplinary team, like, that was just it was just incredible to be around for the patients and really for myself too. And I've really tried to take that and try to bring that back into surgery a little bit. Like, now I'm really tuned into, well, this is my team and I need to take care of everyone else now. I need to make sure that the nurses are feeling okay as well and that my residents feel cared for. So I feel like I learned a lot about how to be a good team leader.
Mm-hmm. So what does that actually look like to be somebody trained in both? Is a surgical palliative care, is that a palliative care specialist or a surgeon who is a palliative care specialist working in palliative care teams? Is that a palliative care specialist who does surgery? Like, what is surgical palliative care?
Well, as far as how that manifests in life for these, you know, 79 or 80 people who are currently board certified, all of my colleagues, everyone has a different career path. So for me, I work full-time as an acute care surgeon. I do a ton of primary palliative care, and then I pick up some hospice shifts on the side.
And your podcast.
That's right. And I have a surgical palliative care podcast on the other side. I have one friend who does half-time palliative care and half-time surgery. I have another friend who doesn't operate at all anymore and just does palliative care. So it looks very different for everybody.
And when we think about palliative care and surgery kind of going together, do we have any data around surgical palliative care or palliative care for surgery patients? Let's separate kind of, now let's focus on the patients.
Well, that seems like a good intro into an article we just read. Do you want to talk about it?
Yeah. Do you like that leading question?
That's good. So the article is titled Palliative Care and End-of-Life Outcomes Following High-Risk Surgery. And it's by Maria Yefimova, who is a nurse researcher at the VA Palo Alto. And it was published in JAMA Surgery recently. Briefly, what they did is this was conducted in the VA healthcare system. This was a retrospective study, meaning they looked back at people who were
high-risk surgeries.
Who'd had high-risk surgeries. And had palliative care consults within 30 days before or after surgery, or not. And outcomes, they looked at family-reported ratings of care, communication, support. And my read of this is that those who'd received that palliative care consultation, I mean, I'm interested to hear what stood out to both of you. Maybe I should start there. What stood out to you? Maybe we'll go to you first, Joe, about their findings here in this study.
One thing, I guess I was maybe more pleasantly surprised by, there's a fairly high proportion, I guess, you know, maybe from a pessimistic view, the proportion of people who actually got palliative care consultations, about a third, like, to me, actually, it was like, oh, that seems not bad.
A third of all decedents. Of the ones who died, like about 30% had a palliative care consultation.
Yeah, and I think that shows a lot of what's happened. So this is in the VA, and the VA has had a kind of been doing palliative care for a long time, and there's a very big push to get palliative care. That number does seem also a little high too. So I wonder if it includes does include folks who also transition to the hospice unit. But it's remarkable that a third of patients saw palliative care in that time frame.
But I would say what was a bit disappointing were all these people ended up dying, and yet less than 6% of them had a palliative care consult before surgery. And so it does beg the question, were these surgeries in line with their goals of care? So that's where I see room for improvement.
Yeah. Do you think there's a role for palliative care before high-risk surgeries?
Well, you know, the world that I work in, trauma and emergency general surgery, that would be considered a luxury, and we don't often get that, although I do feel that surgeons should be doing their own primary palliative care, and so that we should be having discussions beforehand to make sure that we're giving goal-concordant care to our patients. But for a lot of these surgeries, these were not all, they were high-risk surgeries, but they were not all emergent surgeries, and so for these patients who obviously, I think the people who died, most of them, they had like four or more comorbidities. I mean, these were high risk surgeries in high risk patients. And so, yes, I would like to see palliative care be involved beforehand. But another point that it makes in this paper is that we didn't pick up if the surgeons were doing their own primary palliative care, which I do feel like a lot of surgeons are probably having some sort of discussions with their patients, but that's not being able to, that you can't pick that up in a retrospective chart review.
Do you feel like in training programs, there's a lot of palliative care being taught to surgeons?
Joe, what do you think? You're in training.
Right now, no, but we're working on it. I have another research year next year, and I think a big part of what I'm going to be doing is trying to integrate what I'm learning in the palliative care fellowship into our surgery training program. Mm.
I'll tell you, I had absolutely no palliative care training in my institution, and we didn't even have a palliative care team, which is so there was a lot of suffering, patient suffering, and then also resident suffering, because we didn't necessarily have the skills to address the patient suffering.
Well, the one thing, reason I really like this study is, like, if I think back to like 10, 15 years ago, when we were just building evidence bases around palliative care, a lot of it was focused on cancer and working with oncologists. And because we didn't have a lot of studies showing benefit, it felt like always an uphill battle. I don't think I can think of one randomized controlled trial in surgical patients doing palliative care. And so this really gives us some evidence, at least for decedents, that their outcomes were actually better as far as the care provided through this bereaved family member survey.
And it's an outcome that matters, right? Because the patient died, and who's left? It's the family, and they're left with this legacy. And so this matters. I mean, yes, I certainly think it's important to look at 30-day and 90-day mortality in these high-risk surgeries as well. But the fact that we're looking at the people that are left behind, to me, that's so much of what palliative care is about, right? We're caring for the patient, but we're really also providing care to the family.
And when we think about training for surgeons, like, what do you think the most important parts of primary palliative care for a surgeon is?
For me, when I think of primary palliative care skills, I think of being able to conduct a family meeting, being able to have a good goals of care discussion, being able to discuss code status, having some basic understanding of symptom management, which, you know, as Joe pointed out, I mean, we do a lot of that as surgeons. And lastly, having some understanding of hospice, you know, that there's a difference between palliative care and hospice, who qualifies, and more importantly for me, is where is this hospice care going to be given, right? Because I've seen many surgeons walk in the room like, all right, well, go to hospice. Well, what in the world does that mean? So having some understanding of how to negotiate the hospice system. So I think those five skills, if I could have my way.
You know, the other question I have is, we have every intern on medicine rotate with our palliative care service. It's not for very long. It's just for a week. Should we be doing similar things with surgical interns? Either of you can respond to that.
Well, I think this whole year has been great for me, but I can see definitely how, you know, a shorter course would be really great. I think if we could make it work with scheduling, that'd be fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Rad, what do you think?
Well, I would love it. You know, at OHSU, Karen Brazel, she has all of the interns rotate for a month on the palliative care team. At my institution, I wanted to make that happen, but I think the palliative care team feels overwhelmed, so that we have to get buy-in from them as well, because it's a whole other group of learners. Though I tried to explain to them that surgery residents are like, you know, we're some of the hardest working people in the hospital, and we'll probably write a lot of great notes for you and get it done. Right. But I understand that it, you know, it puts a burden on this already really on a team that's already working so hard and is already stretched thin. To have a whole nother group of learners on the team is challenging.
I also feel, though, from like a lot of this is about relationship building. Like a lot of early stuff that happened between palliative care services and oncology services was about relationship building. And I feel like the relationship building between surgery and palliative care, there's a lot of room to grow there.
There's
Both sides to learn about each other's cultures.
Right. It's one of the reasons that the consult rate was so low. You know, it's like, I mean, on the one hand, as Joe says, 30% is better than expected. On the other hand, as Red pointed out, it was like, you know, 5.6% before surgery. We can do better. And a lot of these patients were older and sicker, and they ended up dying. So, yeah. You know, and it's true. You know, you're absolutely right. The people who we rotate with now, those interns, they go on to be chief residents, and then they go on to be attendings. And we have really strong relationships with them because we've known them for years.
Yeah.
Whereas we don't have that same sort of developing relationship with the surgery residents.
It's actually really interesting. It's a good way for me to think about selling it back to the palliative care team. Like, in the end, it's a consult-based team. If you want more consults, get to know these people young, and they will consult you.
Yeah. I wonder, you know, going from surgery to palliative care, we talked a little bit about misconceptions about palliative care from the surgical standpoint, like what is palliative care, what's hospice, what can hospice do? Were there misconceptions about surgery that you saw from palliative care providers or surgeons?
I think we've earned some of our reputation that we have in the hospital for being a bit short with people sometimes and not having great communication skills. What I found, though, is that sometimes there's just not there's a little bit of a lack of understanding of how deeply the surgeon is connected to their patient, especially after they operate on them. And, you know, there have been studies that have shown once people have operated on people, they tend to overestimate the likelihood of them surviving. Like, it just clouds our judgment. And so I think it's just difficult to understand what it's like to truly take someone's life, especially someone's life who may have been previously healthy, into your own hands, and then perhaps have a devastating complication, and then the palliative care team's getting involved. So I found myself just doing some education around that. And the other thing I found was, you know, it's hard if you're not a surgeon to really understand what the kind of typical course of a surgical patient is. Right. So like when you think of something like a Whipple, I mean, as a surgeon, I think not if you're going to have a complication, it's what complication are you going to have? So we kind of have perhaps sometimes as surgeons, a higher threshold for our patients suffering, because not that we want them to suffer, but we kind of know that this is just going to be this long, rocky course that still might end up well. And sometimes we just kind of get lost in that, and we can't see the forest through the trees and that sort of thing. But I did find that even as a learner, as a palliative care fellow, people were coming to me and saying, well, explain, how does this work? Or what are we expecting here? So it was kind of that, there was a lot of relationship building there for me.
Yeah, you know, I loved having Joe on our service as somebody who's in the middle of surgical training, because he actually, one day he drew up on the board what do like efferent afferent loops look like for post Whipple patients? Because I had no idea what people were talking about. And just that collaboration and that relationship. Did I even get that right? Is it post efferent?
Yeah.
I learned something.
You got it.
Joe, thoughts from you about sort of perceptions of palliative care from within surgery?
I think, you know, it's definitely, it's a spectrum, I think. You know, there's, I think a lot of surgeons, like Red was saying, you know, either knowingly or unknowingly are doing a lot of palliative care, primary palliative care themselves, navigating difficult medical decisions with families. But yeah, I've definitely, in speaking with, at least here, different attendings, you know, there's different levels of willingness to involve another team in kind of what they feel like is this decisions regarding like surgical diseases that kind of just falls under like the purview of like the surgeon patient partnership. I remember one, for example, like one attending told me that he just doesn't like calling palliative care. He knows that they can help, but he feels like when he has to call them, it's because he has nothing left to offer. He can't do anything else for the patient. And so it's almost like a demoralization for him to sort of call on another team to help.
Mm. Yeah, it's like a sense of defeat or that loss or, you know, regret.
Exactly.
Yeah, rather than, you know, a wonderful partnership for a patient who is seriously ill, who may have a variety of different outcomes, including death, but also including return to function and survival.
Sometimes it makes me wish, in some of these situations, I don't practice in a place like in an ICU where there's automatic triggers, but sometimes you can see where an automatic trigger, like if a surgical patient has been in the ICU for 30 days, which is a long ICU stay postoperatively, then we're going to just call palliative care. Because again, sometimes I feel like the surgeons are, okay, this is going to be this long, rocky course, but I don't know, 30 days in the ICU is a long time. And I've watched people suffer for months. As an ICU fellow, I was watching people suffer for months, and the surgeon was just not comfortable getting palliative care involved. And sometimes I wish we could just kind of say, well, this is what's going to happen because it's, you know, the best for the patient. And again, for the family too, right? The family suffering, and sometimes the nurse is really suffering too. Mm-hmm. And so just for the whole team, that we can just have another layer of support.
Yeah. Interesting. You should bring up 30 days. Can we talk about that? That, there's a perception for within palliative care that some surgeons are reluctant to consult palliative care because they're concerned about their 30-day mortality rates. And that in some surgeries, these are publicly reported, or that their quality ratings depend upon the survival of patients past a certain date. Thoughts from you as surgeons about that perception?
You know, it's hard for me. I work in a surgical field that we don't necessarily, we're not really looking at that per se, because so many of our patients are coming in so ill. I just would say, I feel for those surgeons. I just feel for them. And I think I just recently was talking to Dr. Zara Cooper and about this, and we were just talking in general about, you know, when you're starting to feel judgmental and like, oh, these people are just, the surgeons just don't want the patients to die within 30 days, to really step back and try to adopt a sense of curiosity, like rather than just assuming the worst, like really what's behind that? You know, if it's really about these reported outcomes, then I just have a sense that there's some suffering from the surgeon behind that as well. And so I feel for them. So just kind of at least coming from a place of curiosity and trying to assume the best. I mean, do some people think like that? I'm sure they do. But that's, I really don't think that that's the majority of surgeons are walking around like that. I really think if surgeons don't want to consult palliative care, it's because they have a false belief that the palliative care team's going to come in and kill their patient, quote unquote, kill their patient and convince them to go to hospice. Mm-hmm. And that these surgeons have really put their heart and their soul into this patient. They really believe that they could help them, and they don't want to, quote unquote, give up. Now, is that right? No, not all the time. Is that associated with patient and family suffering? Yes. But again, just trying to understand where they're coming from, that they got into this field for the same reason as us. We all want to help people, right? It just comes out in weird ways sometimes. And I guess it goes back to what you said, Eric. It's all about like building these relationships. And we're certainly not going to build them by assuming the worst in people.
Yeah, and it just reminds me is that when we do often get consulted on surgical patients, it's when things have gone really, really bad. So our viewpoint also may be clouded. And the truth may be somewhere in the middle. We don't know enough about these, like what does the natural course look like after a lot of these different types of surgeries. And it's up to us, too, to learn from our colleagues in palliative care. Like, is this abnormal? Is this normal? Should we be expecting this? Because I feel like we are to blame, too, for a lot of the poor interactions between the two fields.
Mm-hmm. How so? I'm just curious. How would you...
It's great.
Yeah.
Red Hoffman taking over the host role.
Yeah. Okay. Passing the mic.
Love it.
The surgeon in me, I'm being bossy.
Yeah, I think sometimes we can come in with sometimes a too negative outlook as far as prognosis without actually first learning about... you know, what does the natural history, what does the course look like after the surgery? I feel like where we are right now with surgery is where we were 15 years ago with oncology. Like 15 years ago, we got consulted when things got really, really bad and oncologists felt like there's nothing more that they could do. Everything we just said about the surgeon, that's where we were like 15 years ago. And now we're in a place where when people are getting diagnosed with advanced cancer, like we are just being consulted on those folks while they're still getting treatment. And I feel like studies like the one we just talked about are things that we need to show that working together, learning from each other, and just like with oncology, learning, oh no, we kind of expect kind of these rocky points during this type of chemotherapy. You know, these are the people that are going to get better. These are the symptoms that we should worry about. I don't feel like we're having those conversations with surgeons. I don't feel like we're learning from surgeons about that. I certainly learned a lot when Joe was on our service and building that relationship.
It's great. I wanted to come back to the study just to note that receipt of palliative care consultation, because there is a punchline here.
There's a punchline.
Was associated with better ratings of overall end-of-life care, communication, and support, as reported by patients of families who died within 90 days of high-risk surgery. So in this retrospective study, families reported greater satisfaction with care and better end-of-life outcomes for persons who died after high-risk surgery and received palliative care consultation compared to those who did not.
Yeah, and after adjusting for a bunch of things, like the type of surgery. So it was a really interesting study. Again, we need more like a Jennifer Tamell study or Naval study on surgical palliative care.
Right. Early palliative care at the time of diagnosis of serious surgical illness.
Yeah.
Joe, I'm seeing what's going to happen for your research here next year. This is great.
I think Joe's interested in education.
Might need more than a year for that.
I wanted to ask about what other opportunities do you see for growth between the fields of palliative care and surgery? Are there particular domains, particular surgery is, of course, heterogeneous. We should say, of course, that surgeons are heterogeneous. Some are trained in palliative care. Some have no familiarity with it whatsoever. What are the major opportunities for growth here in terms of the field of surgical palliative care? Is it like trauma surge? It seems like the surgeons that I know who are most sort of understand palliative care the best or most interested in it tend to be trauma. We've got Red, we have Zara Cooper, both trauma surgeons, or vascular surgeons. Their patients are really chronically ill. They have severe vascular disease and their trajectories are generally, you know, they may be able to fix this or that, you know, open up this pipe that or that pipe for a period of time. But in general, a lot of, you know, body parts are slowly disappearing over time. And this is, leads to tremendous suffering for patients with severe vascular disease. And the vascular surgeons seem to be quite attuned to that. Are there other areas where there are opportunities for more growth? I know, for example, here we are rarely consulted by the cardiovascular surgeons. Interested in your thoughts on that. Joe, you want to take that one first?
I was like, oh boy, I don't know about that.
No, I think there's definitely, in terms of like specialty by specialty, a lot of room for growth, sort of beyond sort of what's been, what are the services that are more typically involved with palliative care. I think, for example, like all the other oncologic surgeries that we right now don't typically see. I think also end-stage liver disease has a very like complex role with palliative care because it's very much like surgery or death for those patients. And I think there's a big role for palliative care there. I think, like you were saying earlier, too, besides just approaching by specialty, also kind of integrating into training, I think, will be important. I think that medical schools are already doing a better job of teaching students about this. Like, I was exposed early on. And so I think the residents are kind of the next step of integrating palliative care for surgeons.
Mm-hmm. Red, thoughts from you?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think transplant surgery, I think that would be lend itself so well. I could be mistaken, but I don't know of anyone who's a transplant surgeon who's also boarded in hospice and palliative medicine. And then, as Joe said, the surgical oncologists. And then I think like on another way to perhaps integrate is, there's some departments of surgery that during their M&M, they kind of have like there's discussion around palliative care topics, but I think integrating the palliative care team into our M&M, if they were actually involved in the patient, I think would be so useful. Again, it's an ask on the palliative care team to be coming to another meeting in a room full of surgeons. But I think when we were talking about developing relationships, like that's just the way to get it done, because I have been in M&Ms where we're discussing a patient death and I'm hearing the surgeon say, well, palliative care came and then they took over and then my patient's on hospice and I don't know, but to hear that other, well, this is what I saw with my palliative care eyes when I walked in the room. And I've certainly, when I'm wearing both hats, when I'm the ICU doctor, I'm doing a lot of palliative care, not only on my own patients, but sometimes in getting drawn into the other surgical subspecialty patients that I'm caring for in the ICU. And I have been accused of convincing the family to withdraw care. And, that's not assuming the best of the palliative care team or of me as a palliative care doctor. So it would be so nice to be able to have that very, frank and open discussion in the context of an M&M, I think is always worthwhile.
I love that idea, actually going to surgical M&Ms.
You can really learn how surgeons think when you're sitting in the M&M. So it would just be a really nice insight into kind of the surgical psyche for the palliative care team.
Yeah, and the language and the culture of surgical teams. I got one more question for you. Why a surgical palliative care podcast?
Well, for me, when I was a younger resident thinking about this field, I really started... I didn't have any mentors. I started just Googling and I found Dr. Jeffrey Dunn and Dr. Ann Mosenthal, who have become like my great mentors, really two giants in the field of surgery and palliative care. But I felt like, one, I really wanted to learn more about my roots, so I got to interview Dr. Balfour Mont, who's a surgeon. I mean, I didn't know when I got interested in this that a surgeon was the person who coined the term palliative care. Mm-hmm. So one, it's to kind of celebrate the founders of my field. And then two, to get, for me, other surgeons interested in this field and talking about it and seeing what the possibilities are. And again, I'm not expecting anyone. I think it's great that some people are doing a fellowship. The vast majority of surgeons are not going to do a fellowship, But if we could just all realize what our part is in doing some primary palliative care for our patients, I think it would be amazing. And then lastly, I get to like talk to all these amazing people because, you know, when you have a podcast, everyone wants to talk. So I've gotten to talk to such incredible people.
I think it is absolutely. I love your first podcast with Balfour Mont. Like that is amazing. And it's such a really lovely podcast to listen to, at least for all the Jerry Powell listeners. And for those for your podcast who haven't listened to it, listen to that first episode. It's just really remarkable, and listen to the rest of them too. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I really appreciate your support on this. And yes, Bal was just such an incredible man to talk to. And one thing I've realized in speaking with some of the other older folks in the field of surgical palliative care, they all have the same language. Like it's really just this shared genetic makeup of being a surgeon, but also really being invested in everything that happens at the bedside. Like multiple people have said, yes, what we do in the operating room is amazing and incredible, but there's so much that takes place at night after everything's done, when you're just sitting at the bedside, holding the patient's hand, talking to their family. That's what we're about as well.
I want to thank you for joining us. And I guess for us joining you for this combined podcast.
Did we just thank ourselves?
I just thank myself. Giving myself a pat on the back.
Thank you, Joe, as well. Thank you, Red.
But before we leave, maybe we can get a little bit more Africa.
A little bit more of Africa.
Catching some waves.
And some rays.
I stopped an old man along the way, hoping to find some old forgotten words of ancient melodies. He turned to me as if to say, hurry boy, it's waiting there for you. Here we go. It's gonna take a lot to drag me away from you. There's nothing 100 men or more could ever do. I bless the rains down in Africa. Gonna take some time to do the things we never had.
I catch some waves. Red, a big thank you. big thank you. And to all of our combined listeners, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you to Archstone Foundation.
Good night, everybody.
Night.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of the Surgical Palliative Care Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to stay up to date on the latest episodes. To learn more about the surgical palliative care community, follow us on Twitter at SurgePalCare. If you'd like to get more involved with the surgical palliative care social media team, please reach out on Twitter or via email at surgicalpalliativecare@gmail.com. Lastly, take good care of yourselves and take good care of each other.